Case number 12-5234, United States of America v. Volvo Powertrain Corporation, Appellant, California Air Resources Board. Mr. Street for the appellant, Mr. Toth for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. To retrospectively enforce this consent decree, the government was required to show that Powertrain violated a clear and unambiguous requirement of the decree. The government cannot do so, and therefore the judgment below must be reversed in its entirety. Turning to the merits, the district court erred by reading paragraph 110 in isolation from the other provisions in the decree.
You acknowledge if we did read it in isolation, it clearly applies, right? If all we had was 110, that covers these engines, right?
No, because from paragraph 110, read as a whole, as paragraph 110, you see that the parties were focused on applying the applicable requirements of the decree, regardless of who owns the facility, whether the facility ownership has changed. The only applicable requirements of the decree were those in the primary coverage provision, paragraph 60. Paragraph 110 simply makes sure that engines that were covered under paragraph 60 on the date of the decree remain covered regardless of whether the signatory sells its manufacturing facilities.
There's an awful lot of emphasis on the part after the comma, the regardless part. If we read the principal sentence, principal for the rest of the sentence, the independent clause, as Judge Griffith suggests, it would appear that these engines are covered, wouldn't it?
Well, I have two answers to that, Judge Sintel. First of all, that begs the question of what the applicable requirements are.
We'll come to that later.
And second of all,
whatever the applicable requirements are, they're applicable to these engines if we read that sentence in isolation.
Well, you have to look to paragraph 60 to see whether the requirements are applicable or not. And then if they're not applicable, and they're not here because Penta manufactured and certified these engines, not Powertrain or Construction, then paragraph 110...
Well, they were manufactured at a facility owned or operated by BTC, right?
I think that's ambiguous when you just look at that sentence, because that sentence can only be given meaning...
Who owned or operated that plant?
Powertrain, BTC owned or operated it.
So they were manufactured there, right?
Manufactured at is an ambiguous term unless you read it in context of the whole. I'm willing to say that that's a reasonable reading of manufactured at read in isolation. But when you that begs the question of whether what are the applicable requirements? And the only applicable requirements are those that arise.
Let's start with the basics. So they were made at a plant owned by Powertrain, owned or operated by Powertrain, right?
Correct.
And certificates of conformity were sought for them, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so thus far, it's 2-0 against you, right? But now how do you get out of that? That's where we need to go. At least I need to hear you go from there. Because right now you're in a hole with just those two parts, but dig yourself out of that hole.
Because the question is, what are the applicable requirements that apply to those engines?
Yeah.
And you can determine that by reading paragraph 110 as an independent liability provision. That's what Judge Lambert did. Or you can read it as simply a mechanism that ensures that the applicable requirements of paragraph 60 transfer from a signatory to a company that acquires its facilities. So that's one point. The second point is the regardless of clause that Judge Sintel referenced. It's wholly superfluous under the government's reading. And that's the premise of Judge Sintel's question, is that the government, the decree could have stopped before the comma if the government's interpretation is correct.
You know,
why say regardless?
We've got Shakespearean at times in our application clauses where we've said that sometimes the drafters make surety surer.
belts and suspenders, right? Yeah.
I understand that argument. And in addition, maybe the most persuasive argument to me is that Powertrain does not get any obligations under paragraph 110. It doesn't say Powertrain must ensure that engines made by somebody else comply. And that is in a stark contrast with paragraph 109, which says Powertrain must not circumvent these requirements by doing a list of things.
But it's imposing an obligation on somebody.
Correct.
110.
Correct. And our position is that it imposes the obligation on the company that acquires those facilities from Powertrain. It's a very narrow provision.
Why wouldn't you read it that it imposes an obligation on whoever seeks the certificate of conformity? That seems to be the trigger for all of this, right? When someone seeks a certificate of conformity, that's the point at which the consent decree has traction, right? I mean, that's the point that they focused on. They don't care about the engines that are made that are not going to seek a certificate of conformity. That seems to be the focus of the consent decree. So why isn't that a reading?
I think that's absolutely the correct reading, that's who the obligation is imposed on.
Yeah.
But read in context, paragraph 110 only passes that obligation on to somebody who acquires the facility. But let's just assume that the obligation was on Penta, I mean, which I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. But even if that were the obligation, then that wouldn't justify a penalty against Powertrain. Penta's not before the court. There's nothing that connects Penta's certification of engines to penalties under the decree. In fact, paragraph 116, the main penalty provision in the decree, says that penalties can be imposed on Powertrain when Powertrain certifies the engines. And that should be read as well in conjunction with paragraph 60 and paragraph 110.
Let me ask you, what's your argument about the sort of the economic reality of what's going on behind this agreement? Is this an example where EPA knew that Penta was out there and just decided not to have them covered? Or is it an instance where they made a mistake to not have them covered? I mean, how does your argument about interpretation make sort of economic and policy sense here?
Well, CARB, the California Board, right, admits that Penta was a minor player in the non-road engine market, and that's why it didn't make sense to include them. They still say that before this court on page 27 mm-hmm. of their brief. EPA, for their part, before the decree was signed, certified non-road engines by Penta. So they knew Penta was out there making non-road engines. But they only required Powertrain and construction to come under paragraph 60 of the decree. That's how the parties decided who came under the decree. Paragraph 110 is a narrow provision that makes sure engines covered under paragraph 60 stay under paragraph 60. It's not a provision that ropes in new companies to the decree that could have been covered under paragraph 60. And, Your Honors, even if you think this is ambiguous, then that means judgment should be reversed in our favor.
I'm not quite sure that I fully understand that. Is this a contempt proceeding?
It is the equivalent of a contempt proceeding.
But it's not a contempt proceeding.
Contempt procedures were not used.
Right. So is it unambiguously clear from precedent that it has to be an unambiguous provision, or is it the obligation of the court to resolve ambiguity?
This court's decision in Microsoft provides a valuable framework. Now, that was labeled a contempt proceeding, but the government there sought penalties that were identical in nature to what is sought here. And the court said all Microsoft had to show was that the decree was ambiguous and it could escape retrospective relief or contempt. With respect to an ambiguous...
Where did you preserve that argument that the terms have to be clear and unambiguous as opposed to the standard of review that the violation has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence?
Well, the argument was presented as this is a contempt proceeding, and the government responded in kind, no, the contempt standard does not apply because this is just a breach of contract proceeding. This is just a stipulated penalty provision. And that argument was joined issue on. Now, even if we didn't brief it as fully as we could have below, this is a structural constraint on the district court's ability to retrospectively enforce its own orders. It's like saying the district court could apply something other than the summary judgment standard at the summary judgment stage because the parties didn't brief it to the ninth degree. And so, in substance, if this court were to hold that this proceeding is not subject to the clear and unambiguous test, whenever the government goes to enforce a consent decree in the future, it will never call anything a contempt proceeding. It will simply say, I'm filing a motion to enforce the consent decree. Give me $70 million in retrospective penalties. It's the nature of the relief and the fact that it's a court order being enforced and that the relief is retrospective that determines what substantive standard governs. And we've cited three cases in our brief where three other circuits have squarely addressed this issue. The Hawkins case from the First Circuit, EEOC versus New York Times from the Second Circuit, and the Reynolds cases from the 11th Circuit that all said it doesn't matter what kind of label the government places on a decree. The Reynolds cases said it doesn't even matter if the contempt standard is not raised at all below. It still must be applied by the Court of Appeals in determining whether the decree can be enforced retrospectively. The party's conduct confirms our interpretation of paragraph 110. Penta would have never certified 8,300 engines and subjected itself to $72 million in penalties if it had an inkling that its engines were subject to this decree. Powertrain would have found some way to prevent them from doing that, even though they're separate companies. And moreover, the EPA certified these engines knowing that they were produced at Powertrain's plant. And I can give you the direct site for that on the applications for the certificates. They said these engines are produced at Powertrain's plant in Sweden, and the EPA said, fine, certified under the general regulatory standards. CARB asked a specific question. Are you covered by the consent decree? No, we're not part of construction. We're not covered by the consent decree. CARB stamps its approval on it. It's wholly inequitable to now go back and retrospectively impose those penalties when Powertrain and Penta did not have the opportunity to make a choice up front whether it wanted to seek a certificate for a given set of engines. It would have never certified all of those engines. It would have never let those penalties be incurred because it was only selling a small fraction of those engines for non-road use in the United States.
Can I ask you on the stipulated penalty provision? So you've made the argument that the stipulated penalty provision is confined textually in two ways. One is that it applies by terms only to Powertrain seeking certificate of conformity. The other is that it only, well, I don't know if you make this argument, but that it only encompasses HDDEs. So do you at least acknowledge that the stipulated penalty provision would also apply to non-road engines?
Yes. It says failure to meet the non-road standard. It's just an example of how ambiguous and poorly drafted paragraph 116 is, and it shows that it's part and parcel of the lack of notice that was given here. But turning quickly back to two points on paragraph 110 before I move on to damages, the undisputed surrounding circumstances evidence shows that what the parties were concerned about in paragraph 110 was Detroit Diesel selling its manufacturing facilities to Mercedes-Benz. That's undisputed in the record. The court can take that into account. And finally on that point,
I'm not sure why it matters if you take that into account. I mean, we've said over and over that a purposive analysis is flawed in that it's perfectly possible for users talking about Congress, the same would be true of the consenting parties, to seek to accomplish a broader purpose than that upon which they're focused. Where does it really get you to say, well, they were looking at the acquisition?
I agree there's a fine line between impermissibly looking at purposes and looking at surrounding circumstances, objective facts that were happening at the time of the negotiation. Of course, we think if you just look at the four corners of the decree, it does not
That's
cover
That's where
the,
you have to look. I'm not really... That, you're coming to where I was trying to ask you about.
I understand.
Does it really matter whether we know that they were concerned about a possible acquisition or not?
And one final point on paragraph 110... And that is simply that it's a non-circumvention provision, and something has to be circumvented. There's no allegation that there was anything that Powertrain and Penta did after the decree that they did differently from before the decree. There's government admits on page 38 of its brief, there's no craft or scheme here. There's no circumvention of paragraph 60. Turning quickly to the damages point, Judge Lamberth erred by imposing a penalty, the maximum penalty, by looking solely to the stipulated penalty provisions that he conceded do not apply here. without taking any evidence on whether there was a competitive advantage or unjust enrichment gained by Powertrain. Everybody agrees here that an equitable penalty under the decree must bear some reasonable relation to unjust enrichment or competitive advantage. There's at least three reasons why the penalty here bears no relation to it whatsoever, and therefore Judge Lambert's failure to take evidence on it was error.
Can I ask you one question about that? It's not exactly what you're getting at, but I just on this stipulated penalty provision. So does it apply when Volvo Construction seeks a certificate of conformity?
The stipulated penalty provision does not apply directly when construction seeks a certificate.
You said directly.
Well, it doesn't apply at all. Our position would be that because paragraph 116 is completely silent about when construction can be assessed stipulated penalties, that at that point the district court's equitable authority would kick in, and it could impose a monetary penalty. It wouldn't be a stipulated penalty under paragraph 116, but that's a very different situation than when monetary penalties are imposed on Powertrain, something that the parties addressed for 18 pages. And the parties outlined every time they wanted monetary penalties to be imposed against Powertrain. This clearly falls outside of it. Now, in addition, the equitable penalty was error because it wasn't related to any unjust enrichment or competitive advantage. First of all, because Judge Lambert looked only at the stipulated penalty provision, but as we were just talking about, the stipulated penalty provision only applies when the manufacturer certifies the engine. Powertrain did not certify these engines. There's no link between Penta certifying the engine and Powertrain getting some competitive advantage or unjust enrichment. There's no evidence that's been presented. The government made no argument. Judge Lambert made no finding. At the very least, there would need to be a remand to determine whether Powertrain gets any unjust enrichment when Penta certifies the engines and sells them to its customers. Second, and I'll be very brief to wrap this up. Second, only a fraction of these engines even competed in the relevant market covered by the decree. But Judge Lambert imposed equitable penalties based on all 8,350.
Would that have been known at the time of certification, or is that reading doubly retrospectively here to say whether they competed in the market or not?
It would practically be known at the time of certification from the perspective of sales contracts. For example, we knew that most of these engines were going to our largest customer, Kohler, which was then going to place them into generator sets to power hospitals and factories, and those are stationary engines. We knew that at the time of sale when we contracted with Kohler. So at the time of certification, we knew that, and so they were not going to compete in the relevant market.
When you say recontracted, who contracted with Kohler?
Volvo Penta. Powertrain is completely out of the loop on all of this, which exacerbates the lack of notice that was provided to the company that's being penalized. But we would need to look at how many engines came into the United States and therefore came under EPA's jurisdiction, and how many were non-road engines. If they're not in that category, then they're not even covered up by Section 60 of the decree, much less can they be the subject of an equitable penalty for a competitive advantage. The competitive market the parties were concerned about is engines in the U.S. used as non-road engines. Third and finally, it would be highly inequitable to impose essentially the stipulated penalty on Powertrain when Powertrain and Penta were deprived of the advanced choice that is supposed to be inherent in the stipulated penalty. And as many members of this panel know from the nonconformance penalties cases, the way that works is you're supposed to be able to decide up front whether you want to get a certificate and pay the penalty up front. It's not supposed to work that you present the engine for certification in good faith, the EPA certifies it, and then later the EPA comes back and says all of those engines violate the decree. Because Powertrain and Penta were completely deprived of the opportunity to make a decision of how many engines to certify and how to label those engines.
Did you advance these arguments below?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then the decree should be, at the very least, remanded to the district court for an evidentiary hearing on penalties. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, Brian Toth from the Department of Justice representing the United States. And with me at council table is Mr. Nick Stern from California Attorney General's Office, in case the Court should have any questions pertaining to the California Air Resources Board. Even after the consent decrees in this case and all the companion enforcement actions implemented, it was still estimated that there would be millions of tons of nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere that were allegedly attributable to the use of engine software by Volvo Powertrain's predecessor and the other settling manufacturers. The non-road pull-ahead provision that's, you know, at the heart of this decree in paragraph 60 recoups only a small portion of those emissions that remain in the atmosphere. It's a very small recoupment. And in order to preserve the benefit of the government's bargain, not just in the non-road provision, but in the other recoupment provisions, the government and the parties included paragraph 110, which is a very broad provision, which covers certain conduct that would otherwise escape coverage under the decree. And I'd like to start there. I mean, there's a disagreement, a very vigorous disagreement about whether contempt standards ought to apply here, and we think we've adequately set forth our arguments in our brief. But even assuming that those standards do apply, we still have demonstrated a violation on this record of a clear and unambiguous provision in the decree. 110 has two essential requirements. It covers engines that were manufactured at a covered facility, namely when owned or operated by Powertrain. That's not disputed. It also covers engines so long as certificates of conformity were sought. That's not disputed either. The only real textual dispute in 110 itself is what constitutes applicable requirements. And Powertrain's argument wrote that applicable requirements can only mean something when the facility has been transferred to a third party, deprives the regardless of clause of its independent meaning. And that's so because the regardless of clause has two different possible meanings, neither of which is the one that Powertrain wants to give it. It can mean not considering whether the facility has been transferred, not considering that condition at all, whether it's occurred or not. It can also mean that even when the facility has been transferred, in spite of that, applicable requirements still apply. But it cannot mean what Powertrain wants it to, which is that it applies solely when the facility has been transferred. The applicable requirements are found, and they're essentially the non-road pull-ahead in paragraph 60, which provides that for covered engines, they must, if they're manufactured in model year 2005, they must comply with emission standards that would otherwise be applicable as if they were manufactured in model year 2006. That is the substantive standard that is the applicable requirement here and that nobody disputes was violated for these engines.
What do you say to the distinction between stationary and non-road with respect to certified engines?
So the stationary engines are excluded from the definition of non-road engines. That's not disputed because...
Yeah, what is disputed apparently is whether some of these engines should have been categorized as stationary rather than non-road.
Right. And we agree with the district court that it would be an unworkable and unreasonable interpretation of the decree to require the United States to prove, in order to prove a violation of the decree, to chase down the whereabouts and location of the end use of all these various engines. And that's particularly so when there's evidence in the record that even Powertrain itself and Penta itself cannot reasonably obtain information on the end uses. The evidence is that they have limited information, and it's based primarily on returns of warranty registration and warranty repair claims, which are representative of a very small portion of the overall engines. So, if you will, by showing that the engines were certified...
You would say that counsel's representation, that sales documentation existed with respect to whether these were going, is really irrelevant to that determination, is it?
Well, even if they were stationary today, they could become mobile again if they're moved. So it requires monitoring these engines for their lifetime to determine whether they're covered under that interpretation. I think, by analogy, I think showing that certificates were sought here shows that they were ready to be imported. They were ready to be used in non-road engine applications, and there were no regulatory barriers at the time for their being used in that fashion. So if you will, the fact that certificates were sought establishes a prima facie case that these engines are covered, and the evidence they provided in response just does not meet their burden to respond to that evidence, the prima facie case we've established.
Is there any reason to think that Penta would have tried to get certification if it knew that it was that the decree would kick in?
That's hard to say in hindsight. I mean, I think I agree with my opponent's representation of the ordinary purpose of nonconformance penalties is that if you know in advance, you can weigh the decision whether the penalties are something you can pay or whether you're going to actually spend additional money to increase the technology, ramp it up even further to try and meet the standard. And that it doesn't fit this case where the violations were discovered after the certificates were granted, after the model year had expired. And so we just have an imperfect fit here. But that doesn't mean that the stipulated penalty, the nonconformance penalty calculation, is not irrelevant to the equitable award here. I mean, there is a rationale behind the nonconformance penalty that it's supposed to approximate the competitive gain that.
But isn't it a suggestion that 110 perhaps doesn't mean what you say it means? That those who were involved in the creation of 110 had a different view of it. That in fact it didn't cover Penta.
They've submitted some declarations to that effect, and in the district court we didn't present our own evidence because there wasn't an evidentiary hearing held, and so the evidence remains contested.
That Penta sought certificates of conformance for so many engines. Doesn't that suggest that they didn't think at the time that 110 meant what you claim it means now?
Well, I think we have to start with the text of the decree, and unless the text is found to be ambiguous, looking at the intent and declarations of people who were at the negotiating table is not an exercise that the court ought to engage in. But if it were to do that, then, sure. I mean, Penta had a different role. It was manufacturing a different number of engines, a smaller number of engines in that year than it was later on. Its role changed. But the breadth of 110 guards against that. And, I mean, the benefit to the government of something like Section 110 in providing a clear rule is that there can be innumerable types of corporate transactions or corporate interactions among these various industry companies that the government is not keeping track of. And 110 seems to set forth a clear rule that regardless of what happens, certain conduct will still violate the decree.
If your understanding of 110 is right, then what was the purpose of adding construction to 60?
So they are a party. They became a party to the case, and we could have obtained injunctive relief directly against them had we discovered that they were violating the pull-ahead provision during the year at issue. We could have obtained, we could have used recall authorities and employed the injunctive power of the court to restrain them. We could not do that, for example, against a non-party like Penta, despite counsel's suggestion that Penta would be responsible for the violation here if there were a violation, they say. They're not a party, and so we would not be seeking relief against them in these proceedings. So that we knew that Volvo Construction Equipment was manufacturing non-road engines. They were the larger player at the time, and so we joined them as a party to obtain assurance that we could have them on the hook through whatever equitable powers the court might have, entering direct relief against them. But that doesn't mean that that undercuts the breadth of the text of 110.
And is the way you joined them as a party is by folding them into paragraph 60, or is
it was by actually obtaining their intervention? They moved to intervene. After the decree was submitted, the proposed decree was submitted to the court, and then their intervention was obtained, and the court granted intervention.
Right. So my question is, why add them to paragraph 60? If 110 already covers, or is there something else that's being done there?
I see what you're saying. I mean, they also were on notice then that they would have to be part of the reporting requirements that were in the decree that otherwise applied just to Volvo Truck Corporation. So they were actively, because they were identified as an entity that had to comply with engines, to comply with the pull-ahead when they themselves manufactured engines, in submitting the quarterly reports, the monitoring reports, Volvo Truck Corporation, now Powertrain, had to discuss Volvo Construction Equipment's efforts to come into compliance with that substantive standard. It was clear to everybody that...
So you're saying there were other reasons to bring them in? Because they were already covered by 110, right? But you're saying there are other reasons to bring them in beyond liability?
Well, they were subject. The reporting requirements showed their progress toward meeting the goal. And Powertrain makes the argument that under our interpretation they would be covered in all instances by 110. But that's a factual matter, and I'm not absolutely certain that that was something that was known to the government at the time. I mean, certainly there were certificates of conformity submitted, and they may have had plant locations, but unlike the Penta applications that do say manufactured at Powertrain's facility, I haven't seen any applications in the record from Volvo Construction Equipment saying that all their engines were manufactured at Powertrain's facilities.
Can I ask you a question about the stipulated penalty?
I have a question. You were about to discuss, I think, the amount of the penalty involved here. You referred to the formula in the agreement as having approximated the unjust enrichment or competitive advantage. Can you tell me why the amount reached by the district judge in the styled exercise of equitable power is the proper amount to impose by way of penalty on the offender here?
It best approximates the party's intent in the situation where, although not
that's
literally...
That's a conclusion that it approximates. Can you tell me how we get to that conclusion?
So we start. Judge Lambert started with the parties' agreement and the stipulated penalty provision, determined that it did not literally apply to this situation because for a number of reasons, but mainly Volvo Truck Corporation was not the one seeking the certificates. The court then went and exercised its equitable discretion, and in doing so, looked at paragraph 129, which is important here, especially in the assessing the remedy. 129 provides that in resolving disputes about the consent decree, the court should look to the effect of the resolution of the dispute on the other settling manufacturers. The district court had evidence before it that Caterpillar, incidentally the company that had informed the Department of Justice that these engines were possibly violating the decree, had paid nonconformance penalties for its own violation of its own decree. And the court, looking at the purpose of nonconformance penalties as expressed in the statute itself and in the preamble to the regulation on nonconformance penalties, reasoned that the penalty calculation was developed by EPA in order to approximate to be based on the cost of compliance to the company that's being the technological laggard, lagging behind the development of the standard. And that the penalty was calculated to account for that and to ramp it up so that other companies were not competitively disadvantaged by the technological noncompliance. The court reasoned that based on that, it was equitable to apply what would have otherwise applied if this situation were actually covered directly by paragraph.
What do you say to the proposition advanced by Volvo referring to the Volvo group, advanced by Volvo that they had no unjust enrichment here for Powertrain that should be reflected in the analysis that the court conducted?
So the court adopted a sort of a rule, if you will, by looking to the party's intent in 129 and relying on the nonconformance penalty rule. It relied on the calculation that best approximates unjust enrichment. A regulation is not always going to fit perfectly every single case. It's designed to approximate. And that was it's not an irrational conclusion of the district judge. I mean, this is a realm where the district courts exercise a lot of discretion, and, of course, it's reviewed for abuse of discretion. So there are potentially other ways that the district judge could have approached the penalty question. It could have undertaken individual proceedings and looked at case-specific considerations of harm and unjust enrichment. But by looking to the rule, there was a rationale provided in the court's decision, and I I can't say that that was an abuse of discretion.
Do you agree with your opponent, I guess, that the stipulated penalty provision doesn't apply here because the certificates of conformity were not sought by Powertrain? Because I don't think CARB agrees with you on that.
We're not. Correct. We made that argument below, and we're not making that argument here.
You're not renewing it here.
We've acquiesced on that issue. CARB, you're correct that CARB disagreed. Unless there are other questions, I would ask the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Street, we'll give you back a couple of minutes, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's very important here that the court clear up that the clear and unambiguous standard applies whenever the government seeks retrospective enforcement of a consent decree. Microsoft makes clear that courts cannot resolve ambiguities retrospectively against a party to a decree. Instead, what the court can do is clarify the ambiguity, and then that clarification governs the party's conduct going forward. The government has not cited a single case where retrospective enforcement of a decree is sought that anything other than the contempt standard applies, regardless of the label that's put on the government's request for relief. The government wants the broad equitable power of contempt. It wants the court to be able to impose penalties that the decree doesn't authorize, but it doesn't want the protections for defendants on the front end to ensure that they have clear notice of their conduct.
If we were to hold that the coverage here, that is to say 110, is unambiguous, would the court have been barred from acting in a remedy of imposition of penalty by an ambiguity in other portions of the calculation, that is, in the terms of calculating the amount?
Yes, in this sense.
That's not really parallel to Microsoft.
Right. If you found that the decree was unambiguous with respect to whether these engines were covered,
yeah,
then you would have to reach the interim step, which is to determine whether stationary engines are covered and whether engines outside of the United States are covered. If it's ambiguous on that point, then those engines are excluded from the decree, and then you move to the penalty phase. And we think that paragraph 116 at that point deals directly with when monetary penalties are available, and it says they are not available in effect when it's somebody other than Powertrain that certifies the engines. There's at least ambiguity here when you read paragraph 110 in light of the contract as a whole. The disparate treatment of construction and Penta, construction required to join the decree as a party, even though it's already covered under their interpretation of 110.
If it's a party, they couldn't settle the case without getting them in there, could they? I mean, there's a very practical reason for including construction that would not apply to Penta, isn't it?
But there's no reason that they wouldn't bring in Penta, which also made non-road engines.
Have they become an intervener in the litigation?
No, but the intervention and the inclusion under paragraph 60 are parallel with one another. And there's no reason that...
Were they compelled to intervene?
The parties agreed that they would intervene. And the question is, if they were already covered under paragraph 110, just like Penta is, why couldn't the government just seek the same relief against Powertrain? It's very anomalous to have an independent company being roped into a decree and have independent obligations under their reading of 110, but yet not be a party to the decree. You got to go sue my sister company to make sure I comply with the decree. That's at the very least, that gives rise to ambiguity.
I have one question for you. When $70 million is at stake, sometimes we forget about $6 million, but $6 million is still a lot of money on the interest question. So I just have one narrow question, which is, are you making an argument that you satisfied paragraph 133 concerning the statement of position with respect to your argument on interest? Or are you saying that it doesn't matter because you raised it in the district court?
Our principal argument is that it doesn't matter because it was recognized by the district court as being raised and then addressed on the merits by the district court. The reason it was not raised in the way the government wishes it had been raised was because of procedural anomalies in the way Judge Kennedy bifurcated the proceeding between liability and penalties. That's maybe a little bit too much information, but it's more than sufficient that the district court address the interest point on the merits.
I was hoping that you would respond, so I'll give you an opportunity to do so, to Mr. Toth's explanation of the function of the word regardless in section 110. He He argues that you're reading regardless a little too narrowly.
The regardless of clause, regardless of whether Powertrain still owns the facilities, shows that the parties were concerned about facility ownership and some changes that happened after the decree. Now, you could say, I would parrot back in a sense Judge Sentelle's point, that the parties were making surety sure that if the ownership change occurred, that the engines would be covered. And the government has made the argument that we were concerned about some change in circumstances, some change in behavior after the decree. That's what they just said this morning. But there's no change in behavior here whatsoever. Powertrain kept making...
the government's argument, it is a linguistic one, that clause, regardless of XXX, cannot be construed to say only in the event that XXX. And that would be the government's characterization of what you're arguing. Can you respond to that for us, rather than going back to your original argument? Answer the government's linguistic argument, please.
Well, the linguistic response is that it still begs the question of what the applicable requirements are.
You're changing again. I don't think you're...
Let me respond to it this way, then.
That is a different question. We get to this one first. Then we'll get to the liquor.
I would ask the court not to put so much weight on one phrase read in isolation to drastically expand the party structure, which was to include companies under paragraph 60 when they wanted to include the companies, and to impose penalties on companies only when the manufacturer certified the engines. If I could very briefly respond on the assessment of unworkability on the stationary engines. Mm-hmm. The government has said that we'd have to track down how all of these are being currently used. That's not accurate. The manufacturer under the regulations is only responsible for the first use. And the government cannot claim this is unworkable.
That was back to my question to you a while ago. Was it evident at the time of the application what the first use was? And you tell me there are sales documents out there, but were those accessible to, let alone assessed by the government at the time of the application certification?
No.
Is there a better answer to how the government should have known what was and was not on road or, non-road or stationary?
Well, they may not have known how the engines were going to be used, but that's not how the parties chose to define what engines are covered by the decree. The parties could have said all engines certified as non-road are covered. What they said is all non-road engines, a defined term, that are certified. A non-road engine is only determined if it's sold for use in a non-road capacity. And you might take a look at the supplemental appendix.
I don't think that's right, is it? I mean, I thought the definition of non-road in the consent decree, non-road CIA, JA-477, means a compression ignition engine subject to the regulations in Part 89. And I thought that anything that received a certificate of conformity is subject to the regulations of Part 89.
No.
That's not right?
No. For example, and this goes to the unworkability point as well, if the government wanted to bring a Clean Air Act case against the manufacturer for selling an engine that was certified as non-road with an invalid certificate or that it didn't meet the emission standard, the government would have to prove, they would have the burden of proof, that that engine entered the United States. That's made clear under the Part 89 regulations, and that that engine was sold for use as a non-road engine, not as a stationary engine. If they can't prove those things, then it's not subject to the Part 89 regulations. So to say it's unworkable is nonsense, because it's the thing the government would have to prove every day under the typical regulations. And I see my time has expired, and I thank the court.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.